All right, After Dark. You guys know what it is, Kevin. What do we do in the After Dark?
Mwah. Thank you, Patreon. Keep supporting the pod if you enjoy what we're doing. Hey, even if you don't enjoy what we're doing, keep supporting the pod.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to like it, I guess.
Yeah, you can reach out to us. You know where to find us if you want to gripe. We welcome it. I really love, because Brad mans the Twitter, twitter.com/artofdarkpod. We're both in the Telegram, t.me/artofdarkpod. And I do the Patreon. And the Patreon, you know, I feel like I got prime real estate there, Brad, because,
well, it's all people that just are like, love
they're
the show.
They're the cultists. Yeah. They're on board. Yeah. They're in it.
Yeah. So yeah, Twitter, I get slightly more people just telling me I'm wrong about something, which is also fine.
Yeah. You do a good job.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it.
Did you know that Bukowski was a degenerate, Brad? Somebody had to tell you that on Twitter, right?
I know. I was like, oh, really? Okay, I didn't know. I thought to look at the Wikipedia page.
This changes everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Hold the phone. All right.
So anyway, thanks you guys for joining us. Just quick, remember Emily Dickinson Reading Club coming up soon. It's not a lot of reading. We've got some information on the post about that. I think we and to be honest, you can find all of her poetry for free. This is not like something you even necessarily have to go buy a book for. So but good stuff to know. If you like poetry, you should be Emily Dickinson pilled. If you're trying to get your hands around poetry, this is a cool, good place to start. I think we're going to have a really, really good conversation. So anyway, we are talking more Faulkner, Lovecraft to kind of get this started. And we're going to throw Cronenberg in here. And we threw Lynch in there earlier. Maybe we're going to throw a couple other people in here, too. We'll see. We may, you know, there's a rich Lovecraftian, Lynchian, Faulknerian, Cronenbergian American tradition. And I know there are other people in there as well. But before we get there, I want to, for people who listened to our original Lovecraft episode, you know that Lovecraft wrote something like 100,000 letters in his lifetime, maybe more. And he did mention Faulkner on at least two occasions. So I'm going to give you quick reads of those, just so we know what Lovecraft actually thought about Faulkner. We don't know the opposite. Supposedly Faulkner's wife read Lovecraft, so it's not clear if Faulkner ever did, but nonetheless, so here's a letter that Lovecraft wrote to his friend J. Vernon Shea in July of 1933. Quote, Anderson, Sherwood Anderson, that is, Anderson and Faulkner, delving in certain restricted strata, seldom touch on any chord to which the reader personally responds. We recognize their art, but admire them at a distance. Okay, that's one. This is the more interesting one here. Quote, as for the native rustic population and its psychological twists, it would seem, after all, that novelists like Faulkner and his school are essentially right about the decadence of the backwoods. It is probably true that the sounder and higher grade American stock has tended to branch out in various adventurous ways, leaving the field of small-scale agriculture more and more to those feebler elements in whom repulsive abnormalities are most easily developed. That is one of the penalties of the machine age, which has broken up the relationship between the people and the soil and ruined the thrifty, sound-blooded agrarian element which flourished a century ago in all but a few parts of the country. Today, the hereditary small farmer is more and more in danger of slipping back from the yeoman status to the sordid condition of peasant or poor white. It is so everywhere. My Dunwich Horror dealt with such a retrogressive region in Massachusetts, while the unpublished Beyond the Wall of Sleep touched on a case in New York State. So Lovecraft himself is drawing this connection, though tenuous though it might be, between himself and what Faulkner is up to. And calling out the Dunwich Horror specifically, which is what I, you know, the bit I read in the main episode. So David, tell us a little bit about Cronenberg. I've seen I've probably seen 4 Cronenberg movies or so. I haven't seen all of them. I haven't seen the most recent couple, to be honest, though I need to. It's on my ever-growing list of stuff I don't have time to watch. How do you see Cronenberg fitting into this? Or does he? Did I just force you to bring him up?
He absolutely does. I mean, I tend to believe that as one goes through life, if you were the kind of like teenager who was grasping at the world and like wanted to accumulate media and find out about things, you discover that the things you loved in high school stick with you more and more. And I certainly loved Cronenberg in high school as much as Faulkner and Lovecraft. And I think there's an interesting, this is another ambivalence like we talked about in the main episode, that when you look back on those interests, from the vantage of, 10 or 20 or however many years later, there's a weird mixture of nostalgia for when you were young, right? So something that, you felt very close to as a younger person, but part of what made you feel close to it when you were young is that it was this slightly taboo vision of growing up. Mm-hmm. So something like Cronenberg felt like he was, pulling me out of the safety of my home and into some numinous, dark, sexy media world that was really interesting to me and that I wanted to move toward same way as Lovecraft and Faulkner.
Yeah, for sure. The one thing I thought of when we were mentioning this is in Cronenberg's version of a film adaptation of Naked Lunch, there's a line that I'm not sure if it's a Burroughs line or not, to be honest, where he says, America is not a young land. It is old and dirty, evil. Before the settlers, before the Indians, the evil is there waiting, which could be Lovecraft, could be Faulkner, could be McCarthy, could be frankly Stephen King, right? These are all people who've played in Lynch. They've all played in this territory for sure.
And Stephen King is an explicit, I don't know that his stories are exactly Lovecraftian, but he claims Lovecraft was his biggest influence. And he's definitely, in that tradition of New England Gothic, that goes back to Hawthorne, ambiguously to Poe kind of moved around, but it has a kind of New England connection. But they're definitely, Stephen King is not unaware of the relation he has to Lovecraft. Sure. I mean, in terms of Cronenberg, so one way that he biographically, that he is maybe in conversation with Faulkner and Lovecraft is that he's also someone who created a universe in his hometown, right? In Toronto, which is a bigger place than Providence and certainly bigger than Oxford, Mississippi, but it's still not Hollywood, and Cronenberg made a big point of staying there. And he attributes like all the success he's had to not trying to go to Hollywood when he was young, and like staying in, a place with a much smaller, almost like non-existent film industry at the time in the 60s, and getting these small government grants that would have let him make these films that at the beginning at least didn't have to earn money. And I don't know that any of his films really earn money, but he's able to work within a certain financial structure and within a certain culture and develop like a truly international reach that I think had he gone to Hollywood, there's a famous story that he was friends with Ivan Reitman, right? And they were both, two Jewish like Toronto guys growing up in the 40s, wanting to, making films with each other and their friends and stuff. And at some point Reitman's like, I'm going to go to Hollywood. This is a backwater. We got to get out of here. We'll disappear into, Canadian Broadcasting Company if we don't get out now. And according to Cronenberg, they were literally in the car, like about to go. And Cronenberg got a call from some kind of Canadian like granting body that's like, okay, we'll give you $10,000 to make this film. But that made all the difference, and he stayed and made, Videodrome and The Fly and Naked Lunch. And Reitman went to Hollywood and made Ghostbusters and Kindergarten Cop.
Yeah.
But both of which are good, but we're not talking about that.
Right.
These are probably for a reason, right?
They're two different approaches, but exactly. Both of them have impressive bodies of work for sure. I mean, Ghostbusters is
one of the great pieces of Lovecraftian media. It's 100% pure Lovecraftian horror.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah. But there is a virtue in, we've talked about it, but there is a virtue in just staying where you are and doing it, right? I'm going to make this happen here. And it's like, you know, I think of winemakers talking about the distinctions in their wine from one side of the road to the other. Right. And art is no different than that. Right. You go to Hollywood, there's going to be all kinds of new resources and opportunities and things, but you're not going to make the same films you might have made if you stayed home. Right. Same,
and there's something very, very like non-specific about it. Like, it's not just that it's commercial. It's also that it's like no one's from there. And this, you know, people can grow up in Hollywood, but it's like there's something, same thing with David Lynch, right? That he, mm-hmm. you know, did go to Hollywood, but he retained some like very idiosyncratic relation to his own world, which ironically mm-hmm. he applied to Hollywood and things like Mulholland Drive and Inland Empire in a super interesting way. But he's kind of an exception that proves the rule. Like, I don't think anyone right. else has done that.
Right. In the same way, right. You know? Right. Very interesting. So, yeah. What is the most, this is kind of a cheap question in a way, what is the most Lovecraftian Cronenberg film, do you think? Or is there one? Or is
I think it would be hard to not say The Fly, right? So let's say The Fly. So I think throughout Lovecraft and throughout Cronenberg, at least Cronenberg's, you know, signature body horror films, which would be The Fly, Scanners, Dead Ringers, but Dead Ringers is a bit exceptional. It's more of a kind of clinical horror film. Certainly Naked Lunch. What am I forgetting? You know, Existenz, you could say. But so I think the biggest connection between Lovecraft and Cronenberg is they both have this kind of atheistic paganism, right? Or they both have this sense of like, I know that Cronenberg would describe himself as like not believing in anything supernatural, like we talked about before. And it may be true. That's a difference between him and Lynch. Like, he's not a romantic. He's not or at least not the same type of dreamer. Mm-hmm. You know, and he's really interested in science. He's really interested in the body as it actually exists. But I think what makes this film so interesting is like, that's strange enough. Like, he understands this kind of abysmal horror just in real biology, not mm-hmm. in, you know, he doesn't need aliens or anything else, right? That there's something just like deeply bizarre within what is actually real.
That's true. Yeah.
What is potentially real. And I think a way you could bring in Faulkner is they're both obsessed with blood, right? I mean, Cronenberg isn't interested in race in quite the same way, but they both have this idea that there's something in us, you know, our blood, that kind of allows us to live, that we can't live without, but that is also totally unknown to us and that we don't want to see, right? If we see it, it means there's a problem.
Yeah, it's repulsive and it's a little dangerous.
It's dangerous, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's very interesting. You were talking about that. I was reminded of somebody not American at all, but I was thinking about Werner Herzog. And the specific scene I'm thinking of, he did a documentary in Antarctica. At the End of the World, something like that. I can't remember the exact title. Encounters at the End of the World. And he goes and he talks with some of the scientists who are describing the very small scale world underwater and describing the way all of these animals are preying on each other and things and how horrific it is if you're actually at that scale. You're like, yeah, man, you can just have like a drop of seawater. And if you zoom in on it, it is just a charnel house of like everything killing everything all the time, right? And yeah, you don't need to bring in cosmology for that. The horror is like being fought on my desk here, probably.
He says the same thing, you know, because he does all these jungle movies. Like, when I look at the jungle, I do not see beauty. I see the cruelty of nature. I see horror.
Right.
It is not a beauty. It is not beautiful.
Yeah. He says something about the parrots. They're screaming.
Right. I hear a monkey screaming at night.
I have a good friend from Germany who's a filmmaker, and he says that. Herzog doesn't have the same type of like lovable eccentric reputation in Germany because when he speaks German, he doesn't have an accent.
Oh, right. Yeah, he's just some like
he's just some genius. Some annoying genius. A once-in-a-lifetime cinematic genius.
Oh, he certainly is.
But that dude is one of I don't keep many living heroes. That dude is one of my living heroes. Sure, he's sure. Incredible.
See, when he got shot in the interview and he said it's just a minor bullet.
Right. Just laughed it off. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Unreal.
No, he's the man. Yeah, but there's space for him in this Venn diagram too, I think, for sure. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's something about the 20th century too, that you could say in the 19th century, there was this kind of techno optimism, right? This idea that, you know, we're going to build the railroad and we're going to, you know, catalog the species and understand evolution and, you know, cure diseases and all of that. And, you know, there was a lot of success, but almost like it was so successful. This goes back to some of the Los Alamos stuff in The Passenger, but it was so successful that by the time you got to the 20th century, science had started to re-enchant the world, or had started to like bring a new weirdness and a new horror into reality that wasn't supernatural, but to try to comprehend the scope of something like the atom bomb, or even like what you can see under some of the kind of microscopes we have now, or some of the telescopes we have now, boggles the mind in a totally new way that actually reverts us to like a medieval mindset.
Yes. It is so, it's so powerful, but it offers no answers for death, for the nature of the soul, for the human spirit. It purports to, I mean, it tries to, psychology tries to reduce people into whatever brackets and this and that, but it just, it, and as that power grows, the uncanniness grows along with it. Yeah.
It's like you get more and more clarity on what you don't know. It just like circles and circles and circles the fundamental unknowability more and more clearly without ever broaching it.
Right. And all this talk of blood on this and the main episode we did, just the fundamental existential horror of life is there at all times. Like one day we'll all be in the ground in one shape or form or another. And it's beyond can. There's nothing science can offer us to mollify that. And anybody who says it can is, that's just pure cope.
Yeah. Right. And these processes that like Faulkner and Lovecraft are talking about, the degradation and decay, and they're all also happening like literally within your body too, right? This is something that you're living out, your body, you know, not to get like, not, you know, not to get dark, too dark about it, but like, these aren't things that are just out there, right? Your body will fade, your mind will fade. You know, things you've introduced to it will cause problems. Yeah. Yeah.
But we'll never fade. We'll always go ahead.
Oh yeah. No, I'm going to live forever.
We'll always be here for you, Patreon. Don't worry. Yeah. What are you going to say, David?
We'll live forever only for Patreon.
Yeah. Right. If you get the $10 a month tier, you
yeah, we need some upgrades. I want to see some upgrades. Yeah. Yeah. That's hilarious.
Yeah, so I don't know if I had a whole lot else to say. I'm glad you brought The Passenger and Stella Maris into it, or The Passenger into it anyway. I don't know how you felt about those books. I don't know what your history how much of a fan of Cormac McCarthy you are. I felt like it got a lot of unwarranted negative attention that, to me, if you actually live with these books for a little while, I don't understand it. I mean, maybe if you're expecting to read Blood Meridian, you'll be disappointed. But if you understand what he has done through his career, I thought those things were great, personally.
Me too. I think history will be kind to them. I've only read The Passenger so far, but okay. I think it's... I was kind of amazed by it. I mean, especially because the reviews had been so mixed. But they were... Yeah, it seems like he's... You know, it's still his signature style, and he's... You know, you can't mistake him for anyone else, but it seems like he's actually trying to do something new. Like, he's not just doing a victory lap, you know, or just reminding you that he wrote Blood Meridian. You know, he's like actually pushing it in some direction and really thinking about things.
Yeah, to be a man in your 80s who has nothing left to prove to anybody, to still be taking chances creatively like that, I was sort of in awe of just that aspect of it. You know, as a writer myself, just thinking about like, man, yeah, you could still be doing this in like 40 years, right? Like still figuring out new ways to do this thing. That was amazing.
Still poring over dead artists and their biographies. Can you imagine if we were still at this in 40 years?
You'll have a lot more dead people.
Yeah, well, that's true. Yeah, they never stop. They don't stop dying, it turns out.
Present company excluded. Yeah, for sure.
Well, this was great. Dave, unless you've got anything else, any last thoughts, I think we'll kind of close it down. But this was really great. It's great to meet you and talk with you. I feel very inspired, weirdly enough, for all this darkness.
It's exciting stuff. And you know, it's all like handling volatile materials. You know, it's not morbid. It's like macabre, but not morbid, right? It's about things sparking to life. And maybe this could be a parting thought that I think the deepest connection between Lovecraft and Cronenberg, and maybe something Cronenberg actually learned from Lovecraft, I'm sure he read him, is this idea that there's something in you that isn't you, or that you don't understand how it could be you, that is yearning to evolve or is yearning to be born. Mm. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's like the same way in Lovecraft stories, you always have these, you know, kind of Lovecraft stand-in protagonists who like know that they shouldn't open the book, but open it, right? They know they shouldn't go see what's happening in Dunwich, but they do. And the same thing in Cronenberg. So, you know, in this book we did about him, my term for this archetype within Cronenberg is the heroic pervert, right? So like the
That's lead Kevin.
Character. Yeah, hey. There you go. They're everywhere. They're popping up more and more these days.
You know what? Cosine.
Yeah, okay.
Right. But everywhere in his books, I mean, sorry, in his movies, you have these protagonists who seem to be under no threat. Like they're unusual in horror movies in that no one's after them. They're not like defending their home from aliens or, you know, trying to save somebody who's lost in the woods. Like it's nothing like that. They could just leave well enough alone, but they can't, right? They get a chance to, you know, splice their DNA with a fly or to put their head into a TV or to, in the new movie Crimes of the Future, to sort of grow new organs that no one knows what they're for. And there's some reason in which they can't resist. And I think what makes it so poignant and moving in Cronenberg is not something deeper than curiosity. It's the idea that we as humans are like a middle state of something else, that there's something that we're still evolving into that we may not know what it is. And we may perceive it as horrible because we don't want to change. Like the part of us that thinks we are who we are doesn't want to change. But right. There's always some, it's not just sociological progress, and it's not just technological progress. It's like there's some truly metaphysical progress of something that's trying to like emerge from us, that Cronenberg films are really all about the process of that happening. And it may lead to the death of whoever the person was before, but it always leads to the possibility of the birth of some totally new species.
That's the children of the new flesh. Yeah.
That's the new flesh itself. Exactly. Wow. Exactly. Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, David, this is great. Thank you so much. We're going to let you get back to your evening. Pleasure as always. And, you know, let's stay in touch. We can maybe talk about some other subject sometime and
yeah. All right.
Thank you for having me. Anytime.
Yeah, the art of darkness mythos has just expanded.
Yeah. Yeah. I like it.
glad to help. Very good. Anytime. I'm a big fan of the show. I like it a lot.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Thanks for coming on.
All right.
Absolutely. Yeah.